The Extra Ball.
Hello there, welcome to The Extra Ball. I'm Dan Moylan, with me is Michael Normanton.
Hello.
And Moscow White, Daniel Chapman.
Hello.
Once upon a time, there was a board game cast in 1991. It was called Soccer Supremo. We played it in the early episodes of The Extra Ball. To honour its memory, we made a limited edition mug that can only be won on this podcast. But if you want to win it, you've got to contribute to the show in the form of a question that we can answer. And we request that you send a WhatsApp voice memo to give you the best chance. You can send us messages just via text, like a WhatsApp text message, but it will rank you lower. Two ways to get to the same destination then. You can type in the number 07899555459. Or if numbers baffle you, just go to the web address, thesquareball.net/WhatsApp on your phone, and it will redirect you into the app and fill out the number. The contributions will come at halftime during this show, and we will pick the winner of the mug at the end. But when it comes to competition, it doesn't get much more tense and exciting than this. The quiz, Jamie McMastermind, Quizzy Brown, Catch Fraser Richardson, Funhouse, and some of its many names and the only ones that are on this script. And I've forgotten all the other ones that were sent to us. So if you did send a different one, thank you. Michael, are you in charge of it this time?
We're up for new names though, aren't we? If people have new names, we've got new players now. Can anybody do anything with Robin Koch?
I think I'm in charge of this quiz, but I can't actually remember. I'm pretty sure I am. Should we go with it anyway? Have either of you prepared anything?
No.
No, have you?
Yes, I have. So it's my quiz.
Well then.
Perfect. At one point, we were keeping track of this, weren't we, to see what the score was, but we've sort of given up. I think it's safe to say I'm winning.
We had to drop that because Dan won all his points by cheating, so it became difficult.
Of course.
What have you got for us?
I don't want to give... I think if I tell you even the vague sphere of discussion, you're gonna know about... You're going to start thinking of things and writing stuff down, so I don't want that. So it'll have to remain a mystery.
Will that still be the case when we get to the quiz itself? Will you not tell us what it's about?
No, you just got to throw answers at me. I'll give you a clue. It's not Paul Beasley.
It's going to be my first guess.
Well, we'll play this dreadful sounding quiz at the end of the show. Up first, though, given that we've spunked a load of money on Rodrigo, we're going to talk about record signings. Quick nod in the direction of Phil Hay, who chose this for the Phil Hay show as a topic to discuss on there, and therefore jacked our swag completely. However, we're going to go at it from a slightly different angle. And should we begin at the beginning?
The very beginning.
I mean, you were around Moscow, obviously, to witness these events firsthand because you put them all in your special book. So run us through the early years.
I still have my Leeds City kit hanging up that I bought from the club shop in 1906.
How much was it?
10 shillings.
Were people complaining that it wasn't traditional enough?
It is this is a topic for a completely other day, but I do sometimes wish that Leeds United had never happened so that we could still be wearing Leeds City's Boca Juniors kit. We generally had a yellow chevron on dark blue shirts, but there was one season where we just had the yellow band and it looks absolutely beautiful. It's basically exactly like the best Boca Juniors kits. But what we weren't spending much money on, there's a link, was footballers. We did push the boat out at Leeds City in 1912 for Jimmy Spears from Bradford City for £1,400, despite the club technically being in receivership at the time. But there was never a lot of money. Leeds United, it's kind of sets the scene a little bit for a conversation about record transfers, where what we like about Leeds from the Don Revie era and then from O'Leary's babies, that Howard Wilkinson, what did he do? I suppose he germinated them, didn't he, in his greenhouse. That kind of began much earlier. There was a lot of pride at Leeds that we got promoted in 1924 to the First Division, despite only spending £6,000 since the club was formed in 1919. And we compared it with Middlesbrough, who were relegated that season from Division 1, despite spending £25,000 in a season.
Or as it was known back in the day, doing a Fulham or doing a Villa.
And then later after that, we had Dick Ray, was the manager who I think would approve of us signing Robin Koch, but only paid £3,000 for players in all the time he was manager whilst selling £25,000 worth. So it's quite a limp through the numbers from, I think, and it's also quite hard to tell. It seems like Tom Townsley was our first £5,000 player, soon beaten by Jock White for £5,600 from Hearts. And there was also considering that the authorities considered a maximum fee of £15,000 in the 1950s. They wanted to stop this inflation. Leeds had spent £12,000 on Harold Williams from Newport by then. So although we weren't buying a lot of expensive players, we were bumping up against the acceptable moral ceiling. Rach Carter in the 1950s found the whole thing tremendously frustrating. Basically, every interview we ever did was going, this would be a good team if I could just buy a bunch of £20,000 players. And then the board said, well, you can have £600 for Harold Brook and that will have to do you. And then there was the big boom. John Charles sold for £65,000 in the wake of an even bigger boom, which was the West End burning down. But even then, we didn't really get spend happy. Huey Baird and Don Reavy, both £12,000. Colin Granger, £15,000 from Sunderland, was a record and a bit of a failure. He was a club singer and he was slightly better at that than scoring goals. And that kind of took us into the 1960s with a mighty record fee paid, as far as I can tell, of £15,000.
A ridiculous sum and one never to be broken, surely. Footballers are not worth that much. It's ridiculous. Pay that money to nurses.
It should be pay them troops salaries, which they probably actually were getting in those days, but pay them less because they're only footballers. There is a tendency when you look at old football for people to like announce things as there will never be a bigger fee than this. There will never be a higher wage paid than this. I remember I've got like an old book about football grounds and it's talking about Chelsea's standard. It says it costs like 25 million quid or something. And it says there will probably never be a more expensive stadium built or something. You think, well, I think Spurs have just spent like £1 billion on there. So you're off the mark a little bit.
It's like that old apocryphal tale of the Victorian era in which it was declared that everything that would need to be invented had already been invented and nothing new would ever be invented again. And then suddenly we go in, Bobby Collins, early Reavy era, March 62, dropped £25,000 on him. And that's probably the good jump off point, isn't it? Reavy in charge, our frame of reference, if you like.
And we were in Division 2, signing a first division player. So it wasn't just a big statement in terms of the size of the fee, but it was a big statement in terms of where the club was at the time. And also a big statement given that Bobby Collins was a tiny little man, but absolutely brilliant. Probably, I mean, we could shut this conversation down straight away. Who was the best signing Leeds United ever paid a big fee for, or any fee for? Bobby Collins. The end. See ya. And I'm not bothering with the quiz.
And if you're going to disagree, you're also disagreeing with Eddie Gray, because Phil mentioned this on our podcast with him, but I've heard Eddie Gray talk about this before as well, and he basically says Bobby Collins completely transformed things at Leeds, and he could do things that no one else in the team could do, and despite having played through the era of, you know, Bremner and Clark and all those people, he still rates Bobby Collins as the best he ever played with.
And not to mention that Phil agrees with you, Moscow, and picked Bobby Collins as his number one from this list.
It was an incredible footballer to start with, just in terms of ability. Obviously, you have to take a lot of people's opinions as read on that, because there's not a lot of footage to watch him, but you don't have the kind of testimonies that come with Bobby Collins without being incredible. But what we can speak to is his anger, which really helped. He was furious that Everton let him go, and he arrived at Leeds, which Don Reavy was beginning to turn it around, but Leeds for ages had been a club where nobody really cared what happened. It's kind of, this is stories before Reavy was manager, when it was Jack Taylor in charge, that he used to send the players off on runs around Beeston and they'd just go to the shop and buy ice creams, weren't bothered. Bobby Collins wouldn't stand for any of that. And he was a good 10 years older than the likes of Bremner, and certainly a lot older than Eddie Gray. And there was Norman Hunter coming through, Gary Sprague, all the kids. And he was just driven by fury. I think the players at Leeds didn't know if they respected him or were just absolutely fucking terrified of him. But either way, they were doing what he said, no question. And it's an underrated factor sometimes, but this is still the era when you weren't really supposed to coach from the sidelines. We see it now with like Bielsa has his coaching staff giving instructions to everybody and tried to have the guys with Bluetooth headsets on the other side of the pitch for his first match at Leeds. It was not the done thing, and you it was strictly against the rules for a coach to be standing on in his technical area. Or there wasn't even one then telling the players what to do. You didn't do it. It was down to the captain. And Bobby Collins was the captain and essentially ran the games. Absolutely vital.
And this list then charts us from early River era with Bobby Collins all the way through to Rodrigo as, at the time of recording, the most recent big signing. And 60 years to all intents and purposes. We've only broken that record 18 times since Bobby Collins. So let's go through them. And that's March 1962, which was beaten quite substantially, actually, in August 1962. So a matter of only a few months later, when we paid £53,000 for a young man by the name of John Charles.
Club had gone mad. I mean, it was a huge fee for obviously a legendary player. And there was a lot of excitement about John Charles coming home from Juventus, where he had been incredible. Juventus hadn't wanted him to go. They'd offered him a fortune to stay, but Charles really wanted to come home and kind of raise his children back in Leeds. And the whole thing, though, was just became a really bad idea. Started off wrong because to pay for him, the directors had basically personally paid the £53,000 fee because the club was already in huge debt already. But because they wanted their money back as soon as possible, season ticket prices immediately went up by £3. Well, two and a bit, from £7 and seven shillings to £10. And this was £2 more than Manchester United, who were in the first division. And Leeds were going to be the most expensive team to watch outside London. And Leeds is not a city where it's easy to get people to part with money for anything, least of all soccer, when they could just go and watch a proper sport like rugby.
It's basically what Bates did, apart from the bit where we signed a good player.
And the other problem was he wasn't a good player at this point. Serie A was a very different league and it was much slower. And bringing John Charles back into Division 2, he wasn't fit. He couldn't score goals. He couldn't sleep at nights because he couldn't work out how to play. Him and his wife's kind of idealised view of Leeds soon sort of slipped away when they realised it's actually horrible and cold and Italy's probably a great place to bring up your children and take them to school. And yeah, he was quite clear about it. It was a mistake to come back. And Leeds, the one thing that was smart about it from Leeds United's point of view was that the directors, after the first couple of games, they climbed down on the ticket prices because nobody was going to Leeds. The attendances just dropped. But they immediately went to the press in Italy and started saying, maybe put some stories out about John Charles might want to come home. And they managed to, within a few months, sold him to Roma for a profit. We bought him for £53,000 and sold him for £65,000, which is a profit of an amount that I can't calculate. £12,000, isn't it?
It is. And I was saying when we recorded with Phil the other day that you can actually benchmark these record signings and the way that they were broken by managerial era. And Bobby Collins and John Charles, they're the two early Revy ones. There's a load in the post-Revy era, and we'll get round to like Wilkinson and so on in just a bit. But then there's only sort of two significant ones in the mid-Revy era, which is kind of testament to Revy's approach and the approach of the club to bring through all these young players and have this homegrown squad. And the two players, September 1967, Mick Jones is the first six-figure signing when we pay £100,000 for him, followed by Alan Clark a couple of years later in June 69, when it went up to £165,000.
Looking through this list, actually, we'll kind of go through all of it, but I was fairly reassured about Rodrigo looking through this because I know there's a couple of sort of high profile failures on there, but mainly you look through it and you can think, okay, that makes sense. And when you look at Mick Jones and Alan Clark, and you think, okay, maybe spending money on players is a good thing. I know we've kind of become conditioned to think it's a thing that leads to ruin and disgrace, but actually this mainly works. And Mick Jones, you can't really fault anything he did for Leeds, I don't think, can you? I don't think I've ever heard anyone suggest he was anything other than brilliant.
And Alan Clark as well. I mean, these two players completed the team, essentially. The one thing Leeds United have never been able to do properly is grow our own strikers. Even John Charles, who was the best striker in the world, was a centre-half. So we had to buy these two. The season before Mick Jones signed, our top scorer was Johnny Giles, and he scored 12. And there were players we're having to go. Don Weston tried. Alan Peacock's fitness had gone. Whichever of the green offs it was, they can never get them the right way around. We just couldn't find a homegrown striker. So rare for Don Revie to get the checkbook out. But yeah, Mick Jones first, then Alan Clark the second. Alan Clark probably being the higher profile one because he'd already, we were paying a British record transfer fee for him. It wasn't just our record transfer fee. And he was already the British record transfer holder for moving to Leicester for £150,000 the year before, which the whole thing pissed off Jimmy Hill as well, which was hilarious.
Egotistical, gifted, obsessively in love with success, and some say with himself, a description of Alan Clark in the Sunday Express.
Which isn't really a vibe I get from Alan Clark these days.
It was probably fair at the time, though. He did have this kind of attitude, or at least this aura of being a star footballer, which at the time people were saying were odds with his achievements. And what had pissed Jimmy Hill off was that back in the day, you got players got 5% of the transfer fee, and Clark had moved, Fulham had got relegated with Clark up front. So he moved to Leicester and got 5% of a British record transfer fee. And then Leicester got relegated with Alan Clark up front. So he moved to Leeds and got 5% of a record transfer fee. And Jimmy Hill, the quote, and I loved finding this, it's in Alan Clark's book from the time, but it says Jimmy Hill wrote that football is a team game. And Alan Clark, you won't half be worth some money if you ever get that in your noddle box. And the risk was that this he had this reputation for just moving on for money, and he was a big name and a big star. And Leeds United already, everybody knew it wasn't a team with stars, and how it was going to work was a big question. And how it did work, and I don't know if it was deliberate on anybody's part, but Billy Bremner grabbed Alan Clark as soon as he was through the door of the club, and they became roommates and best friends. And if you hear Alan Clark talk about Billy Bremner nowadays, you know, he says he wakes up every morning and thinks about Billy Bremner. And within a short period of time, obviously you don't know if these things are ghost written or what they reflect from reality, but the what was coming out of Clark was, yeah, I might have been a star before, but now I'm at a club where there aren't any. And I realized, you know, these players are all as good as me or better than me. And if I, you know, if I think I can go around with a big head, I won't last 5 minutes here.
And skipping forward now then to post-Revie and another 5 years forward from the signing of Alan Clark. And you can see the pattern here across the next few signings of Leeds dropping money on players in a desperate attempt to try and build a new side. And we go to Duncan McKenzie in August 1974, just shy of £250,000 from Forest. And brilliant ability to jump over small family cars.
He had lovely hair as well. I have a photograph of Duncan McKenzie at an old football annual where he's wearing an Admiral tracksuit and he looks absolutely fantastic. It's almost like the perfect 1970s Leeds United photo. It's the kind you'd want to cut out and frame and put on your wall, only it's Duncan McKenzie. It's not anybody good, which is a little bit unfair because he was actually a great player, but it was difficult for anybody's face to fit at Leeds, especially if Clough had signed you.
And Paul Hart came in nearly 4 years later on March 1978, £300,000 from Blackpool, went on, of course, to become our youth team coach, more famously for younger listeners.
It's one of those that because of the era he played in for Leeds when we were basically crap, I honestly don't think I've ever seen him play a game for us. Have either of you?
Yeah, I've seen bits and pieces, and he was one of the few who could sort of hold his head up through relegation, sort of gave his all and wasn't part of the slacking off that encouraged Leeds into Division Two. But he did kind of, I think his real achievements at Leeds probably are as not just the 93 youth team, but was there for the bunch that came through under O'Leary as well. He really, really did do a lot for Leeds later in his career.
And then Alan Curtis in May 1979, dropping £400,000 on a third division player from Swansea.
I mean, somebody must have seen something in him. I think the context for Alan Curtis and then the player that comes after him, Peter Barnes, for more than twice as much. In between, Jimmy Adamson, who was the manager at the time, had a scheme where he'd been in touch with Kevin Keegan's representatives. Kevin Keegan, the European Footballer of the Year, playing for Hamburg, who you would think would be out of reach. But you've got to remember, Leeds United were still decent. We were getting to semi-finals of Cups and getting into Europe. £500,000 was Kevin Keegan's release clause from Hamburg, and the plan was to spend another $500,000 getting Peter With, striker from Newcastle, put them together, and that probably would have been fantastic. However, the Leeds United board sounded expensive, all this, sounded a bit spenny. And the other thing to bear in mind from this time is that Don Revie, when he left the club, always said that he left Leeds as league champions with £2 million in the bank. By the end of the 80s, by the time we were relegated, we were £2 million in debt. So trying to get money out of the board at the right time was difficult. And it's maddening, really. £400,000 on Alan Curtis and then £930,000 on Peter Barnes in 1981. In between, Southampton signed Kevin Keegan for that $500,000 in 1980. And he was brilliant for them. Southampton finished sixth, which Southampton had no business doing. But because they had the European Footballer of the Year, that helped. To think that we, you know, it was not beyond the realms of anybody's ability to sign Kevin Keegan for Leeds at that point. And instead, we decided he was too expensive and it was more sensible to spend more money on worse players.
Alan Curtis should have just stayed in Swansea. When you look at his career, started at Swansea, goes to Leeds, goes back to Swansea, goes off to Southampton, Stoke, Cardiff, back to Swansea, goes to Barry Town, back to Swansea, where he's essentially stayed since 2004 in one capacity or another. But some people just fit at a club, and he was not meant for Leeds.
I get the sense that he likes Swansea quite a bit, me.
More than anyone has any real reason to, I would say.
To the mailbag, and you can get in touch via the contact details at the start or the end of the show. James has done that. Let's hear from James.
All right, lads. I've been enjoying the League One Chronicles on the podcast over the past few months, and I was just wondering, after listening back to Kandall's eye gouge and Gradle's lunatic implosion, what's the red card that's been given to a Leeds player that's made you the most furious at the individual? And on the flip side of that, is there a red card that, even though we've gone down to 10, that's given you a little bit of pleasure? I'm thinking Berardi against Accrington, just for the sheer art of it. Cheers, lads.
Favourite red cards? Max Gradle, surely.
I mean, not fair. That's one that was infuriating. I think I felt sad about that as much as angry. I think I felt angry at the ref because I didn't really know what Gradle had done at the time. I assumed we were being robbed by the Football League rather than by an angry midget. Cooper at Cardiff, I remember being really annoyed at that. That one where he'd just been booked and then he did a ridiculous tackle and it was just felt so unnecessary. It was in a completely danger-free area of the pitch. He was somewhere by the halfway line, as I remember it, more or less. So that was a bad one. And I remember Rahubka getting Tom Lees sent off, because that felt particularly unfair on Tom Lees, because he was just stood there and Rahubka threw the ball at his arms.
An innocent victim in many ways.
It always seemed to happen to Tom. It was never his fault, but he always got the blame. What was his face? Zach Thompson. He bore the brunt of Neil Warnock yelling at him from close quarters for not much as well, didn't he? That was kind of a shame.
What's wrong with your fucking head? He said to him, didn't he?
Exactly. And the Liam Cooper one you mentioned, it's always weird that Thomas Christiansen sent Matches Click away after that game instead of Liam Cooper, if he was basing his grudges on that match. But Viduka is the one I would add. The two I would add, really, from a relegation from the Premier League when Viduka had been having a difficult season because his dad was ill in Australia, so there was all sorts of things going on. But he came back for the running, and you're thinking, if anybody can get us out of this mess, Viduka is seriously, you know, an international class striker and he can do it. And instead he got sent off, I think, was it against Leicester, for time wasting in injury time, which is stupid. And then obviously the Bolton game, where just, why did you do it, Mark? Why did you do it? Why did you elbow that man when there was no reason to? It wasn't even like a big incident. He just did it and he was gone and we were down. And it's just a sad way for Viduka's story at Leeds to end.
Starting the quiz early here, but do you know where Zach Thompson is playing now?
Neil Warnock's back garden.
Dandenong City, an Australian club formerly known as Chelsea Hyduck. That's weird, isn't it? Some strange stuff going on there. But yeah, they've got a half Croatian badge. It's quite nice. I'm going to support them.
Which half do you prefer, Chelsea or Hyduck?
Oh, the Hyduck bit, definitely. Well, they're not called that anymore. Dandenong now. Dandenong City Soccer Club.
Which do you prefer, Dan or Denong?
It's going to be Denong by default, I think.
I'll tell you what red card I was so furious at the time, but looking back, I think is one of the best. Would have been the one at Arsenal. Was it Danny Mills when he kicked the ball into Ashley Cole's arse when he was laid on the floor.
Yeah, I thought that. And I also thought the one where he essentially just booted Craig Bellamy in the corner. I think was Bellamy trying to just hold the ball there to waste time or something? And Mills got fed up of waiting for something to happen, so just decided to absolutely smash through his legs. But it was Bellamy, and he did deserve it.
Because he was an arse. But then again, it's turned out that Danny Mills is a bit of an annoying arse in retrospect, isn't it?
True. I seem to remember quite enjoying Alan Smith's against Valencia as well for the sheer anger of it. Because I think it sort of summed up how I was feeling at the time. They'd been, before the game, Bowie had that last minute ban. They'd opened the score with a handball, and everything felt unjust and like it needed someone to just go down with a bit of a ball of flames, just take someone out on our way down. And that was Alan Smith.
A nihilistic red card. That's what you're angling at, isn't it? The nihilistic red cards are always the best ones.
Yeah, just we're going out anyway. Fuck it. Let's have one of these.
Let's move on now then to the question from Ryan.
All right, lads. With all the hoi polloi of promotion and that, I've got a bit of a left field question. It's been doing my nut in, and it's just come to me now for some weird reason. What's the deal with Matt Grimes and his mum? Because I've heard you mention it a few times on the podcast, and for one reason or another, I might have put it at the back of my mind or something like that, but is he like, does he shag his mum or something? What's the deal? Like, because they'd always take it piss out of him and his mum. Just wondered, that's all. Thank you.
Who's your favourite Leeds United Oedipus? Pierre-Michel Lasogga?
I mean, we should probably state for the record, although we don't know, do we? We don't have any evidence that Matt Grimes does definitely shag his mum. Let's just say that for now. It's not certain, is it?
It's not something we've ever considered. Therefore, we've got no evidence either way.
Yeah, it all goes back to her. It was a Facebook post, wasn't it, when he was just about to leave, and she put, we've managed to find it, "Woohoo, so buzzing. Get that van ordered to get my boy out of that place with the horrid fans. Little football, little van emojis. And get that holiday booked. Dubai, here we come."
I'm pretty sure this was either just after we'd missed out on the playoffs, or it was the day of our last match. But certainly it coincided with football was still being played. I think it was the last game we played QPR, and it would have been, I can't remember if he was on the bench or whatever, but if he's...
I don't think football was being played by Matt Grimes at this point. I think he'd been well and truly bombed out.
But he probably still had his club tracksuit that he was handing back ahead of his loan finishing, while his mum was all over Facebook, only to her close friends, though.
It definitely was before the last game was played, actually, looking back, because there were follow-up posts on it. She's obviously replying to someone here. Honestly, so buzzing. She's fucking irritating, isn't she? The way she writes is annoying. "I've already drank a bottle of wine and I haven't even been drinking lately." Of course you have, Becky. Rachel Gage, her friend, says, "It's the result you wanted. Celebrate, mate." She put, "Unless they win about woo again." She loves woo. She looks putting words with lots of O's on. "Unless they win by about 15 goal next weekend, they are out. That's karma, mate. Don't cross me." As if somehow she is in charge of Leeds United failing to win games.
That was it. We didn't play QPR at the end of that season. We played, it was when we went to Wigan on the last day, and we had to win 14-0 if we were going to make the playoffs. So this must have been just after we'd basically messed up the playoffs that Phil Hayes said were nailed on twice.
But they went, I mean, the Dubai here we come bit. So is she going on holiday with Matt Grimes at this point when he's like...
Going on holiday with his money, that's for sure. Or our money at least.
Is there any truth in the rumours that they were going to Dubai together and sharing a double bed?
Not that we're aware of. That remains unconfirmed. But, I mean, that's karma, mate. Don't cross me. Crying, laughing emoji, kiss, 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 as the sign-off there. Does she now realise that karma has had another rethink of this and we are now in the Premier League and precious little Matty Watty is not?
She's taken her eye off the ball of being in charge of karma, I think. So it's managed to slip through. But I'm sure she's still there. Very happily spending her son's money.
And this one comes in from somebody who didn't leave their name.
Are you collecting the new stickers, the Panini stickers, or is it called Panini Elite, I think? All the best, lads. Bye now.
I think the last sticker book I had would have been about 1992, I'm going to say, ish.
I'm pretty sure mine was France 98, which was a bit of a strange one because you don't normally get international ones, I don't seem to remember having many of them, but yeah, I had that. But I mean, when we were going through the fixtures, we were basing our assessment of them largely on sticker albums. I've got a Merlin Premier League 94 sticker album in front of me here. And you know what? I won't be collecting them, but strangely enough, I think stuff like this actually does matter just because it means we're back in a proper league. I remember being at school and there were kids who supported like non-Premier League teams, but they had to pretend to also like a Premier League team because they actually supported Halifax or Barnsley, but they couldn't really join in with stuff like stickers and, I guess in later years, computer games and things because their teams weren't on there and did like just like Elland Road doesn't have a proper stadium on FIFA and things. So I think it's stickers are not, they're not like the be all and end all, but I think it's what it represents is quite nice. And I hope like a new generation of fans now can enjoy having swapsies of Pablo.
I'm going to disagree with you there, Michael, because my sticker books were all predominantly World Cup sticker books, Mexico 86 and Italia 90. Those were the ones that I collected rather than the sort of workaday Football League or Premier League ones. However, little story for you. My mate James, who I went to school with, he picked Aston Villa as his team to support based on the fact that he filled them first in his sticker book, in his Panini sticker book.
Christ, so he saw the face of Gordon Cowans and Kevin Richardson and thought, these are the men for me.
I think I am going to go for the stickers. I always think that when a World Cup comes around or something, but then I see the price, that's the problem. They are a dear do nowadays. I might just take refuge in my shoebox full of Pro Set cards because I don't have to buy them again because I already got them. But no, I am quite into it. And I agree with Michael. I spent some time browsing the souvenirs sections of Liverpool and Manchester City's online club shops a few weeks ago just to sort of see what's there. And there's some exciting stuff. I'd quite like a Gianni Alioski doll. you can get these kind of like, you know, replica players. They're a bit moved on from the older Corinthian ones that, forget his name now, but there's an excellent Leeds fan who repaints them on Twitter and does a very good job. And I always like his stuff. But yeah, you can get like a foot high Mohamed Salah if you want one. And I want that. But Leeds players, it's interesting to see what level you get to though, because I looked at Burnley for comparison and it was very much still that kind of Ensley League level garden gnome stuff. You know, you can get some like a Dairy Milk that says Burnley on it, things like that. So it'll be an interesting barometer of where Leeds United get to is the level of tats that we have available and how much of it makes its way into my house.
I think the last time I actually bought stickers, thinking about it, was the 2006 World Cup because I went over to Germany with my mate for it, and it's kind of well known how tight I am now on this podcast, but somehow I'd managed to find a German man who was willing to let me stay at his house for free. It sounded bad. It might have been bad, but he turned out he was really nice and he was just a bit of a sociable fella. But he had he had three kids and a wife and everything. It was all perfectly legit, but he was letting us stay there for free. So me and my mate, his kids were all like collecting the stickers. So we went out pissed one day and spent about 50 euros on stickers and just brought them back and like chucked them in the air and watched the kids go absolutely mad. So kids do still like stickers.
You know this theoretical Gianni Alioski doll there, Moscow? You do know that if you were to get one with working orifices, it'd still be the mouth that would be most offensive.
Why? Why bring working orifices into what was a nice, wholesome conversation? Michael even managed to, you know, successfully dodge the sex dungeon that he was being kept in Germany. And then here you are with I don't even want to say the words again.
Well, we left the transfer record story around Peter Barnes and under £1 million. We're about to leap forwards into a whole £1 million and a whole 9 years in the future from the signing of Peter Barnes into 1990 with John Lukic.
A story that begins with us selling him for £75,000 plus £50,000 if you made, I think he was about 25 appearances, which given, I think he played something like 250 games for Arsenal and won the league, we did get paid. So that was good business. We got that £50,000. And this is shortly after we'd sold his understudy to Peterborough for £4,000 is what we got for David Seaman. And then, yeah, the way the world turns around, Arsenal bought David Seaman from QPR for £1.3 million and we bought John Lukic from Arsenal for £1 million. Maybe we should just have kept them.
Both of them.
Could have glued them together. Nobody's getting past that. Imagine John Lukic with David Seaman's ponytail. There's an image.
I can't imagine John Lukic with anything other than John Lukic's hair.
He's never had anything else.
If it ain't broke, don't fix it. It's like him and Stuart McCall just have the same haircut from sort of the mid-80s to present day.
If you've been listening to the Matchball 30 over on the main podcast feed, you will hear us chart the journey from 1990 through to 1992 between promotion and lifting the league title. And you'll see how crucial these signings were. And he really was one of the most important jigsaw pieces in this whole thing. For all that we laugh at John Lukic punching the ball into his own net in subsequent years and being very, very uncertain with the ball at his feet and the back pass rule, look that one up, kids, being changed. He was a damn fine keeper.
I am having to review my opinion of John Lukic, having watched some of these games back, because my opinion from as a mid-90s Leeds fan was that he was shit and needed replacing, but it turns out he was actually dead good.
He should have played for England many times. It was absurd that he never even got at least a cap. It was daft. He was the best goalkeeper in the country after he signed for Leeds. He was brilliant for Arsenal as well and should probably have got England caps at that point. But his first season with Leeds and then the season we won the title, I don't think anybody was playing better as a goalkeeper.
Moving forward another year then into May 1991. This one for me is where this list on a personal level peaks. Anyway, the signing of Tony DiRigo for £1.3 million from Chelsea, who arrived at Leeds, let's not forget, thanks to a contract dispute with Ken Bates and an absolute bargain. He would have been at twice the price. He was brilliant, was Tony DiRigo. Probably, I think, my favourite ever player. If you never saw him, he was the complete left back. I can't ever remember him making an error. He was lightning quick, brilliant at passing, unbelievable crossing, and perfect timing with his tackles. And I would say, if we hadn't had the Reviera, I think Tony DiRigo would have been right up there in our best 11s, the teams that we tend to pick, you know, picking our favourite players from across the years, because he was so good.
He bumps Terry Cooper very, very close. And some of the things that might even push him above Cooper are kind of unfair on TC, because he had a bad leg break, which meant he missed some of our biggest games and then kind of lost his place to Trevor Cherry when he came in. So there's that kind of that element where DiRigo could possibly sneak past him. But I think it's safer just to say that you could play either of them and you wouldn't see much difference. Both quite similar as well. Terry Cooper had started as a winger and so was still a brilliant attacking fullback. And yeah, Tony DiRigo going forward, fantastic. And I'm sure he did make mistakes, but the thing was, he was so quick. If he made one, he'd just run back and solve it himself. So there was never a problem.
I think it speaks volumes that for pretty much everyone who didn't see the Revy team, Tony DiRigo is still the left back that every other left back is measured against.
He was quality, but he only held this record as the record signing for 31 days because Rod Wallace came in June of 1991 as well. £1.6 million from Southampton and came with a free Ray, his twin brother, who came as part of the bargain to keep him company from all the way up in the north, from down south in Southampton.
Rod Wallace was probably my first favourite Leeds player when I started watching, as he seemed to have the most about him. It just seemed the most exciting player in that side. Admittedly, it was on the sort of downturn of the Wilkinson era, but he was another one, I guess a bit like Lukic, admittedly seeing it through a child's biased eyes, but I always felt like he should have probably got an England cap somewhere along the way.
He was an England B international, and there are some photos of him in that 1990 World Cup shirt, and he looks fantastic. So purely on that basis, he should have worn it more. But he was brilliant. Like when I interviewed Brian Dean a couple of years ago, he compared him to Griezmann in terms of the way he played and what he could do and his like explosive dribbling that he could just produce from nothing. And when you watch those games back, we were great in the title-winning era, and then the years afterwards, it did get quite grim, quite regimented and trying like a very strict pattern of play, but then the ball would land at Rod Wallace's feet and he would just do something. The goal against Tottenham, that one goal of the season, was not actually unusual for him. He scored one against Norwich in the game where we lifted the title trophy in 1992. Admittedly, it was kind of a day off for everybody, but it's still a brilliant individual effort. And he would pull those out a couple of times a game. There would be a run and a dribble and a shot where you thought, if that had gone in, it would have been goal of the season. Yeah, he was fantastic. And long service as well, both him and Tony DiRigo. It was George Graham that finally saw them off.
Too attacking. Get rid.
Basically, yeah, we got David Robertson instead.
and play a fullback up front.
And then with Wallace, I think they just didn't negotiate a new contract for him, so he went to Rangers to actually get some decent wages.
And score a hell of a lot of goals up there as well.
He wasn't done by any means. I mean, Wallace and Hasselbank were great together, but I think Clyde Vinehard was seen as cheaper.
Rod Wallace, actually, looking back, was a lot better than I remember him at the time. I think as I've grown older and more mature and have been able to look back on it, you see just what fine qualities he had. Moving forward then into the summer of 1992, Leeds United had just been crowned champions, and we went and did something insane. We paid not £1 million, but £2 million, which felt like a big barrier to cross at that time. David Rowcastle arrived from Arsenal, all set to replace Gordon Strachan, but Gordon Strachan, as it turned out, didn't quite need replacing.
It's all a damn shame, this. There's kind of an alternative timeline where, as good as Strachan carried on being, Rowcastle at its best could have kept us at that high level. And if we'd just done that swap of Rowcastle for Strachan and kept Batty McAllister's speed, I think wonderful things would have happened. There were two problems, though, as you say. Well, several problems. We needed a right back more than we needed a right midfielder was the biggest thing. Strachan's back, he'd only played 45 minutes of the games in the title running because he couldn't get through a whole game without being injured. And we had a penalty against Coventry City that he let McAllister take because he just didn't trust himself to be able to kick a ball in a straight line. He was kind of useless. He was out on the pitch, living off pure adrenaline and determination to get the title won. And then he had an operation that summer. And the idea was Rowcastle would take over, but the operation worked. Strachan, too influential, too brilliant to drop. The other problem was that Rowcastle he'd missed a season with a serious knee injury himself. And that was a big reason why George Graham had sold him, had basically recognised that his knees weren't up to First Division football as was and Premier League football as was coming. And I think might have seen Leeds United coming a little bit, particularly with the fee. Rowcastle, after Leeds, went to Man City, went to Chelsea and never really put together the kind of games that his ability before 1992 and before his knee injury deserved. Because if you look at some of the games of him playing for Arsenal in the 1980s, absolutely brilliant footballer. And I wish we'd got him at his best.
And a very nice guy as well. And obviously a lot of tragedy surrounding his passing later on at such a young age. 1 year on from that then, July 1993, we went close to nearly £3 million quid with Brian Deane from Sheffield United. And I always felt a bit sorry for Dino, and I know you've spoken to him a little bit more extensively, Moscow, because he came with a massive burden when you think about it, because he was a Leeds fan, record signing, Chapman replacement, and somebody we'd coveted for ages and ages.
Chapman replacement was his problem. That's what he came up against and what he struggled with. And when I was preparing for that interview, I watched as much of him at Sheffield United as I could. And you could see it quite easily what the problem was. Leeds, with Chapman up front, had spent basically nearly four seasons. Chapman with his back to goal, nodding on long balls for people around to pick up. But that was kind of how he played. Back to goal, then he'd turn, run into the box and head it in. When you watch Dean playing for Sheffield United, always running onto the ball. There'd be a ball in front of him, either over the top or across from the side, and he's always running forward and attacking it. And the two things didn't go together. The Leeds team weren't being flexible. They were just expecting him to do what Chapman did. He gave me the impression he kind of went into his shell a little bit. He didn't know what to do. He couldn't throw his weight around and say, no, you need to play the way I want you to play, until the end of his first season when he was completely sick of the whole thing. He said his friends thought he was completely depressed. He was just coming home from training, sitting in his house, hating his life. And he was his brother encouraged him to go in the next year and say, just tell them how you need the ball, how you want to play. And people joke about the idea of Brian Deane ending up on the left wing at Leeds after our next record signing. But that's where he actually started being brilliant, because you kick the ball in front of him down the wing and you give it him to run onto, and he does things from there with the ball at his feet and the game in front of him, or the ball at his head and the game in front of him. He was really good. It took a long time to get around that. And there was a sense as well that I think Howard Wilkinson would probably have preferred to pay the £4 million for Duncan Ferguson But Ferguson decided he wanted to play for Rangers and he wanted to go to jail. And so we went and got Dino instead.
I feel like history has been quite kind to Dean because there was certainly quite a lot of criticism of him at the time. I think because he hadn't replaced Chapman and he didn't score as many goals for us as he had for Sheffield United. It feels like now people are pretty much universally agree he was a good player for us. Whereas I'm not sure that was necessarily the case at the time, even though I have to say I always really liked him.
I don't know if it's universally agreed that he was a good player for us. I think it's agreed that he was a good bloke for us. The kind of the effort was always there. I mean, there's some games you watch back and it was ridiculous. There are games where Brian Dean will hit the post three times and you can see in his face, he's like, what do I actually have to do to score a goal? And he scored the goal that got us into Europe at Tottenham, which kind of sums up what he was good
Great
at.
Great goal, though.
You would never see Lee Chapman pick the ball up in his own half and run past three defenders and shoot. But once Brian Dean got into that, he did perform well. And, you know, Lee's like, he's from the same school as David Batty. They were at school together. And I think it kind of got forgotten because he took that route through Doncaster and Sheffield. But Leeds lad coming home, everybody always wanted him to do well and could see that it was a question of the style of play rather than anything that Dean was or wasn't doing.
And did eventually score four goals in one game for us. It would take another decade for that. But when he had his little comeback in 2004-05, again, did a fairly decent job for us, as I remember at that point.
He did, and only five players now on the list ahead of Rodrigo, one of which is probably right up there with the best, certainly most enigmatic strikers we ever had, who came in 18 months after Dino, January 1995, £3.5 million, or thereabouts, from Eintracht Frankfurt, Tony Yeboah. Everybody knows about Tony Yeboah. We've seen the videos, we've seen the goals. What a player.
He probably says something about the way a time frame seems to fit together when you're a child, but Brian Dean to Tony Yeboah felt like about 10 years to me. It seemed like there was a huge expanse between those two, but really not very long at all. But I mean, just loved him. Probably as much as I was saying Rod Wallace was my first sort of favourite player and I really like Brian Dean, Yeboah was the first like proper love I had just for the things he'd do. He's like, he's just the perfect footballer for a kid to like.
And he sold everything as well. Leeds had a funny team at that point. We were playing Dean and Whelan up front and Dean and Masinga, and Rod Wallace was kind of in midfield and we were playing three in midfield, but we didn't have Batty, so there was no cover for defence. It was all just a mess. Yeboah through the middle, everything suddenly just made sense. You put Dean and Wallace either side of him and that was that 4-3-3, and we were brilliant from that point on. Goal after goal after goal. There was the, I think he was 10 goals in 11 games at one point in his first half season. I can't remember what he ended up with, but he was, there was a weird period when he signed where he didn't play for a while. And I think it's Wilkinson was doing a bit of a Bielsa on him of getting him fit. But then when he started playing, his first game, you just saw that his touch and his ability were just a level above any of the strikers we had at the time. And when he started scoring goals, he just couldn't stop. And there were so many of them were so great. It was unbelievable.
Again, it says a lot, I think, that he played relatively few games, was an expensive player who left for nothing. But no one has bad memories of Tony Yeboah, other just because of the moments he did give us, and the clips you can look back on are up there with absolutely anyone who's played for us.
Oh, absolutely. Genuinely world-class footballer. But then again, so was the next one who came in later on that year, back end of 1995. And this is where I think it probably started to go a little bit awry for Wilkinson. A player who he didn't ever really want. You always felt this transfer was driven by Bill Fotherby and his travels around Europe and his bid just to sign somebody, anybody, sort of fancy and continental. And a player who plays in what you would probably term like the Pablo Hernandez number 10 position these days, like an advanced midfielder slash forward, just never made sense at Leeds because we didn't play like that. Even when Wilkinson was tampering with his formations and maybe going to 4-3-3 instead of 4-4-2, there's never room for that player behind the striker in that, is there? There's always either a central striker or two up there.
I mean, we wonder why Brian Dean struggled to show his best at Leeds. At the time, constantly, we're signing Skaravi, striker. We're signing Ruben Sosa, striker. There were others as well, basically just flying around Europe, being linked with every striker going. And then Dean is on the pitch every week, just going like, you know, what the fuck? And eventually pulled Thomas Brolin out the hat. And as you said, Howard Wilkinson did an interview with the Square Ball years ago, where he said it's the only transfer where he's had a bad feeling that they shouldn't go through with it. And has gone through with it anyway. Any other time he's had that feeling, he's gone, no, let's not do it. but he went against his better judgment and decided he's been good before, maybe he can be good again. And no, he couldn't. He had his moments, but no.
We did do an early episode of the Extra Ball about Brolin, I think, didn't we? If you want to go back and listen to any more excruciating detail about the many ways he was terrible.
But even then, you wanted him to succeed. You really wanted him to succeed at Leeds because he was such a high-profile name, but his face just never fit.
I loved him at first because I remember Euro 92 going in the playground, and when I scored a goal, I would do his celebration, you know, where you jump in the air and you spin. So when he came to Leeds, I was like, fantastic, Thomas Brolin. But then you realise, like, if he tried to do that celebration then, he'd just topple over like a big weeble.
£4.5 million from Parma, that one, Thomas Brolin. And it looked like towards the back end of his career, he was enjoying the Parma ham anyway.
I think the one thing we can give Thomas Brolin some credit for is that because we signed him for £4.5 million in November 1995, it means we're not discussing our £4.5 million record signing, Lee Sharp.
Small mercies and all that. Yeah, another one who didn't quite work out. But July 1999, so we are nearly 4 years hence from Thomas Brolin. And Michael Bridges arrives from Sunderland for, I think it was an initial fee of about £5 million plus some other bits, wasn't it? But I didn't know much about him when he arrived, other than he was kind of a young and up-and-coming player. But he was absolutely fantastic. And it's such a shame that he got that injury and injuries.
It was a strange, expensive signing because he'd played some games for Sunderland, but not all that many. And he'd not actually scored that many goals for them before he signed for us. And it was in the summer where we'd lost Hasselbank, wasn't it? So he had all of a sudden a huge amount on his shoulders. But then I think it was his second game, wasn't it? He scored that hat-trick against Southampton. And everyone was just like, oh, maybe this season's going to be absolutely fine. Particularly because one of the goals was, it's like a volley or a half volley from the edge of the box. Just an absolutely brilliant finish. And it was, he all of a sudden just looked like he was good enough to play for a top Premier League team, even though we'd not really seen much of him before then.
Yeah, edge of the box, he wearing our new blue Lazio kit, he controlled the ball, I think on his thigh, and then before it bounced, volleyed it into the top corner. It was the kind of goal Letizia had been scoring at the Dell for years and years, and Michael Bridges just went down there and pissed all over him. Yeah, Sunderland was, at this point, it was Niall Quinn and his disco pants, and Kevin Phillips was their strike partnership. So Bridges couldn't really get a look in. But it was a good bit of business, actually, given the quality that we got to take him from Sunderland. And the Geordie Bergkamp for that season, he was just fantastic and scoring a lot of goals, playing brilliantly. When we signed Wilcox, and it could be Kewell and Bridges up front with the option of Smith, you just thought, there's no better attacking outfit in the world than this bunch. And they're all 12, so we can enjoy them for years and years. But yeah, injury after injury after injury with Bridges, and it's a damn shame.
It's quite telling, looking at his career stats, that the greatest number of appearances he had was for Sunderland in his early years. He actually made 79 appearances between 1995 and 1999, according to Wikipedia. And he only scored 16 goals. You're absolutely right, Michael. He didn't score a great deal. Leeds, he made 56 appearances with 19 goals. So he's, you know, a sort of a 1-in-3 striker or thereabouts when he played for us. But looking down the list after that, he never made sort of more than 20 or 30 appearances for anybody else throughout the English leagues. Quite a lot for Newcastle Jets in Australia towards the back end of his career. But in terms of the English divisions, that was pretty much it. He never really stuck. That injury really did for him.
I think his goals, were they all in that first season as well? Or certainly nearly all of them were, because even though he did play after that, he never found his form again after the knee injury. And it was a bit like Lucas at the same time. Like every time you actually did see him on the pitch, any tackle on him, the whole crowd was doing like a, ooh, this could be the end of him again. And quite often it was, unfortunately. So it ended a bit badly for him at Leeds as well with that loan to Newcastle, where I think he said something as a joke, basically, that he'd deliberately missed a chance against Newcastle a few weeks before it. But it was obviously a joke, but it's one of those things that just got taken out of context. And I think there was a slight feeling that, you know, we'd essentially been paying his wages for several years by this point without seeing much return. So again, a shame how he left, but I think he's one that, again, we look back on fondly, more or less.
Definitely one of the best bits of business that we did was July 2000. So 1 year on from Michael Bridges, and we're in peak O'Leary era now, and we did some fantastic team building at this time. And actually looking through these names, and particularly the arrival of the core for £7 million from Lens, makes me regretful that we didn't do better during this era, because Decor was absolutely top class. Would you class him as world class?
I would say so. I think he certainly had two seasons for us in which he was world class. I wouldn't have swapped him for anyone else in his position, I don't think, at the time. I'm just trying to think. I guess it was like Patrick Vieira and Roy Keane were kind of the other Premier League holding midfielders who I guess could be compared to him at that point. But I would say Decor was certainly up there with those two.
And David Batty, also world class.
Yes. And what a midfield with those two in it, though, together.
Yeah, Batty said he doubted it would work. He was coming back from injury and he basically assumed Decor was taking his place and wasn't too impressed with the whole situation. And he said they didn't really get on. Like they didn't really talk much. It wasn't like a Andy Cole, Teddy Sheringham hatred. It's just like they just didn't really click. But then they were put into midfield together when Batty was back fit, started playing alongside each other. I said it was just wonderful from that, but they just got each other, and that it was those two together was just fantastic whenever it happened. And that kind of drove us through the second half of the Champions League run. Anderlecht in particular, where you've got Decor and Batty plays that through ball. The whole thing is just wonderful. And yeah, £7 million, £7.2 million, because Peter Ridsdale made sure that was printed on the back of a shirt when they presented the court to the press. And you'd pay 10 times that for a player like him now. He was wonderful. What Terry Venables didn't see in him, I would love to know.
Quite refreshing in these days of undisclosed fees, that where clubs are trying to, you know, keep the cards close to the chest, not wanting to show how much money they've got in the market. Not Peter. Yep, stick that on. We can even put at the bottom, can you print how much money we've got left to spend as well? Just put that in the small print, and just so everyone knows.
I mean, to take it right back to the beginning, when I was trying to track the growth of our transfer fees in the 1920s, just after signing Russell Wainscote for £2,000, we signed Tom Jennings, who's still one of our top 10 goal scorers, from Raith Rovers for a fee that was only ever described as undisclosed but substantial. So even back in 1925, they loved an undisclosed fee. And even before that, Leeds City signed Freddie Blackman from Huddersfield. And the Huddersfield, he was the captain by the Colne. And because they knew it would upset the Huddersfield fans, they wouldn't reveal the fee. They just said, it's a lot. Don't ask how much. Just, we got a lot for him. Please leave us alone.
Returning to Olivier Decor, I'll say this about him, that you did think initially that he would be brought in as a Batty replacement, but actually he was far more dynamic than that. Batty was just in there doing Batty things, but Decor really was. It was box to box. They talk in modern terms about a player having a great engine. He was absolutely sensational, was Decor.
He could do a lot of, I guess to give him a modern comparison, he was doing some Calvin Phillips stuff, but then with a bit more attacking intent thrown in there. Well, he did also, a bit like Batty, sometimes look a bit terrified with the ball in front of goal, but he could certainly contribute to attacking stuff. His through balls and stuff, and his linking up a play was brilliant. I think that midfield, even if it may have been a bit of an accident, that it did work. But I think with Bowyer and Kewell in that same midfield, who were pretty much relentlessly attacking, it did kind of work having two holding players.
And not a bad year, that one, in terms of signings, when you fast forward from July 2000 to November 2000. And of course, we didn't have the transfer windows as we've got them now. You could just go out there and drop money on players whenever the hell you liked. And that's something that Peter Ridsdale liked doing when it came to dropping £18 million, which was, you know, we spend that in the blinking of an eye these days. But at that time, back end of 2000, was a phenomenal amount of money for Rio Ferdinand. I remember the press talk at the time is that Leeds might go for 10, maybe 12 million, and then suddenly 18 million quid. And I gather from my dad bumping into Peter Ridsdale at the shop once, I think it was in the White Rose Centre, all in, it ended up costing us somewhere in the region of 22 to 24 million, this deal.
I mean, if West Ham had held out Peter Ridsdale, they'd probably still be going up now with the price he would have paid for him. But you have to say, kind of worked. Whatever it was, whether it was luck and we did overpay for him, he was brilliant. I was doing a bit of research on this, and I actually felt sad looking at the pictures of him signing and the press conferences and stuff, because I guess a little bit like now when we're signing good players and it feels a bit like anything's possible. It felt like we were on the verge of being champions at this point. He seemed like he might be the missing piece. I know Lucas had a lot of injuries, and it seemed like we already had Woodgate. If we could just bring in another brilliant young defender, it's like these two can play for us for the next 10 years and we'll go on and we'll win stuff. Obviously, it all fell apart. But for this brief period, I think it felt like anything was possible at Leeds.
Just signing every good young English player possible. That was the the policy. That's why we were constantly linked with Frank Lampard as well, and Kieran Dyer, Matt Holland, anybody who was English in the early 20s and good, Leeds were going to overpay for them. What always makes me laugh about the signing of Ferdinand and the fee involved is, I mean, who even knows the ins and outs of how that transfer got done, because there's the conflicting stories of how O'Leary was involved in these things. But O'Leary basically wanted him and wanted to play three at the back, which quickly didn't work. Ridsdale went out and got him, and then O'Leary went straight to the press and started saying, well, I mean, no player's worth that, is he? You can't be paying fees like this for players. And there's certainly, I don't know if it's retrospective, but in Ridsdale's book, there's certainly an element that he was looking at his manager and going, what the fuck are you doing? Ridsdale loved being out on the pitch, showing off the player, and he loved going to O'Leary and saying, I've got you the player you wanted. Don't you worry about the money. And then his manager's out in the press going, well, I mean, it's a bit steep. I don't know what they're playing at Leeds. You're the manager.
There's plenty to go at when it comes to Rio Ferdinand. So should we do an episode about Ferdinand separate to this, because time is marching on? So there's probably quite a lot to say about this, given the scale of the deal and where he ended up.
We can do a Scum special with maybe him and Smith in the one episode.
Beautiful. What a great listen that'll be. And that brings us round to today and Rodrigo and 27 million up front plus add-ons and a record that stood for 20 years. And Rodrigo saying most recently that it's an honour to be Leeds United's record signing for now.
We'll record this bit now and we can, you know, it'll surely be correct. Obviously, he stayed for 5 years, became the club's record scorer, and was still there for when we lifted the Champions League. So I don't think you can fault him, really. I think it's been a great signing.
I think we can prepare it for 10 years when Rodrigo and Pablo Hernandez are the joint managers who've delivered our sixth consecutive Champions League. Great days. These have been great days.
It was nice watching him for Spain, I have to say. Just to go back to that era of feeling like we might be good again. Just going, yeah, wow. Someone actually good enough to play for Spain and Leeds United at the same time.
Michael, you're on the quiz. What is it?
Kits. You're going to be taking it in turns to name either a kit maker or a sponsor that we have had. I have 26 on my list. Dan, pick left or right hand. See if you go first.
Point of order. What has this got to do with Zach Thompson?
Nothing.
Well, then why earlier did you, when Zach Thompson's red card came up, were you like, that's got a lot to do with the quiz?
No, I said it was just fast forward into the quiz. That was like a sub quiz. That was the warm up.
Oh, it was just, right. Okay.
It has nothing to do with Zach Thompson. Zach Thompson wore at least one of these shirts.
I would just close the Zach Thompson Wikipedia page tab.
So was it sponsors or manufacturers?
Sponsors or kit manufacturers.
Right.
Since we had them, they were just white shirts at one point, weren't they?
Who made those? I don't know.
I'll go left hand.
It's in the right, so Moscow goes first. I'm going to give you, let's say, 15 seconds as a maximum between them. So, yep, you don't have to wait for me to say yes or anything. Just roll straight into the next one. Moscow.
Admiral.
Umbro.
Asics.
Macron.
Thistle Hotels.
Nike.
Strongbow.
Adidas.
Wyton Mackay.
Enterprise Insurance.
Yorkshire Evening Post.
32 Red.
Bet 365. What's wrong with that?
Stoke City, you idiot.
We never had him.
I said Bet 24.
No, you didn't.
I said Bet 24. Anybody can hear that I said Bet 24.
You said Bet 365, as the record will show.
It's the famous logo with the circle, and it's got the number 24 in it.
Yep.
And then around the edge, it says 365, because you could bet 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. That was the whole thing. People who were really into that company called it Bet 365. And then that other Bet 365 came along and stole it.
Right. That sounds like you're making that up.
Well, let me close this out by saying it's the boat top. Our most recent one. That's a win for me. Thank you.
Spot up.
This is actually one of my geeky areas, this, because I used to love designing kits as a kid, so I know all these quite well. Burton, Top Man, Lion Cabinets, WGK we had, didn't we, for a bit?
There's another three-letter one as well in the early days.
Right, fucking wankers.
Right Fucking Wankers, that's the one.
We had around that same time, the other one, I can't remember the name of it now.
Sys Time.
Yeah, began with an S, yeah.
Yeah, Burton Top Man. I don't think anyone got Red Kite either, which was a particularly dark era for us. I think it was that the first season in League One, Red Kite?
White and Mackay we had as well, not to forget those. Did we have Net Flights?
I said them. I said White and Mackay.
Yeah, you said Bet365 as well, you clown.
Don't take away the ones I got right.
Bet365, you idiot.
Packard Bell, did we have them?
Just showing off now, nobody's impressed.
Another win then.
The dub, as the kids say.
Right, well, I will bring something to the table next time out then. Let's pick a mug winner. Who is it?
I quite like thinking about the red cards. Or do we talk? We wanted to give it to Matt Grimes' mum.
What? Send her a mug?
Well, let's give it... Why don't we give it to Ryan on behalf of Matt Grimes' mum? And if he happens to bump into Matt Grimes' mum, then he can pass it on.
I hope they do meet, because he's clearly got some questions for her.
Right, so well done to you then, Ryan. You can have the mug. Get in touch. We'll sort you out with that. And we'll catch you next time on The Extra Ball. We'll see you in a bit.
The Extra Ball.